All right, we'll move on to new business. Section 8 of our agenda, item A, update, discussion, and possible action regarding the compassionate use program, including consideration of increasing the number of licenses to operate as a dispensing organization. And that will be Chief Wayne Mueller and Deputy Director Jeff Williams.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. Wayne Mueller, Chief Regulatory Services Division. Wanted to give you an update on where we are currently with the compassionate use program. At a risk of being a little bit redundant given public comment, the program did begin out of the 84th legislative session in 2015. It was very narrow at that time with only one condition that was prescribable, being the intractable epilepsy, as was stated previously. At that time, the mandate for the agency was that at least three licensees be brought online by the fall of 2017. The agency did that with the first licensee coming on September 1 of 2017, and then the other two licensees began operation in that same calendar year, I believe in October and December. The legislature then expanded the program in the 86th session by adding several additional conditions that were prescribable, as you can see on that list, including multiple sclerosis, terminal cancer, and then the last category being the incurable neurodegenerative diseases. The mandate with that item was that HHSC develop rules to define that category, which they did. And there are now under their rules several dozen subcategories that meet the definition of that item. Then in the latest session, the 87th session, the legislature again expanded the program by adding non-terminal cancer, and also notably PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, was also added as a prescribable condition. They also increased the potential potency by allowing the prescription's final product to be as much as 1% THC as opposed to previously, which was 0.5 THC. As a result of these expansions that the legislature has done over the last couple of sessions, next slide, please. Not surprisingly, we have seen an increase in the patient population. This is a lifetime patient population number. As of January 2021, we were at just a little over 4,100 patients in the program lifetime. Fast forwarding then to today or July of this year, 18-month window, we are now a little over 31,500 patients lifetime in the program. That does indicate that about 26,000 have come in and filled at least one prescription in the last 18 months. And so with that, next slide, please. Projecting that out, that comes out to about what we've seen in the last 18 months is about a 10% month-over-month increase. And because of that, one more, please. If we project that over to the next 18 months, we could be seeing as much as exceeding 150,000 patients in the program as we reach December of 2023. And even if that is viewed as a little bit of an aggressive model, a more conservative one would still show us reaching potentially 75,000 to 80,000 patients in the program around the end of 2023, and therefore still looking at hitting that 100,000 patient number somewhere within the next 24 months. And so since we are seeing this increase, as one of the public commenters stated, it is rising fairly rapidly. It is incumbent upon us in order to make sure we maintain statewide access to make decisions and plan now in anticipation of that, that what we're seeing as potential growth over the next 18 to 24 months. And so to that end, three things. First of all, staff have been working on some draft proposed rules for the CUP program, some cleanup that needs to happen from changes that happened last legislative session. And yes, most notably, there will be a rule in there that changes our rules that allows the current licensees to have the remote satellite locations where they can store product and be able to better serve patients throughout the state. That is already something that we are planning to do. We are in agreement that makes sense at this time, given the growth of the program, and it is my plan to bring that forward to you. Hopefully, I'll have that ready to you at the next your next meeting in October, if not definitely the December commission meeting, and we will bring those rules for you to consider to put forth for public comment. The second item is, as you heard, one of the licensees has not prescribed or fulfilled a prescription in some time. Staff are in recurring contact with that licensee, and they understand that that is not indefinitely acceptable. They needed to undergo a bit of a business model restructuring, I guess would be the best way to put it, and they are doing so. They have provided us a description of where they are now and what they think it'll take to get to be back to active. I've asked that they give us a bit more of a detailed timeline with some milestones that we can hold them to. And their new CEO has promised that that is forthcoming. So I am confident that we will get the third licensee back to a point where they are active and being involved in prescribing in this program in the near future. And then the third item being we are a member, Texas through RSD is a member of CANRA, which is the Cannabis Regulators Association, which, as the name implies, is an association of many of the state cannabis programs around the country. And that has proven to be a really good wealth of information for RSD staff, being able to discuss items with other states that have already been there, done that, that are more mature programs, learning some of their lessons learned. And from that, staff have networked and met individuals that have some really good experience with those other state programs and are now in consulting capacities. And so we're looking at the possibility of bringing in a consultant, most likely through a procurement, to come in and take a look at where we stand so that we're not trying to reinvent any wheels here in Texas. Given where the program stands now, where we're projecting that the patient population might be here relatively soon, what do we look to see as being the next steps? And so all that leads to a question that seems to be on several people's minds of, are we going to open up the window to take applications and add new licensees? I can tell you it's not my plan to do that this coming Monday morning. But given the population increases that we're seeing, it does appear that adding licensees is a possibility. But we do want to take a measured approach to that. We don't want to just do it. As you heard from opposing public commenters just a few minutes ago, there's various perspectives on what makes the most sense. And we would agree it needs to be a measured approach. And so those items that I described previously, getting the current licensees to be able to have better coverage through remote locations should help. Getting the third licensee that hasn't been active back to active should help. And then getting a fresh set of eyes and getting some expert advice in here, I believe will help us to the point where we can make an informed decision so that we are seeing if, when, and how many new licensees, if all that makes sense. And so that's the path that we're planning to do right now, is take a bit of a measured approach, but still move in that direction. And of course, I will keep you all updated on what our progress looks like as we go down that path over the next couple of months. And so that, in a very brief nutshell, is where we currently are with the CUP program. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have, commissioners.
So on the issue of the data, as Chairwoman Click noted earlier, and the reliability of the patient count, you said that 24,000, I think you said, in the last year have filled a prescription?
It looks like it's about 26,000 in the last 18 months.
18 months. That's a little more firm understanding of the data than what she said. And I just want to say, are you fairly confident that the data that we're collecting on the demand is sufficient to arrive at a reasonable recommendation on the number of licensees?
I agree that it's time for us to evolve a little bit. We've been traditionally posting that lifetime number, again, through CANRA and learning lessons from other state agencies. It appears that the typical way to report is a two-prong approach. active patients being a patient who has fulfilled at least one prescription in either a 12-month or a 6-month time frame seems to be the prevalent piece. And it's, at this point, I don't know. I haven't seen anything why definitively 12 months versus 6 months is better. I think it's just something that looks recent in time. But importantly, that number in conjunction with reporting what milligrams of active ingredient has been prescribed in the last week or month or year. Those two things in combination seem to be the prevalent way to get an indication of the growth of a program, and we will be moving to that in RSD here in the very near future.
Okay. I understand you're looking at a comprehensive approach to addressing the ability to offer this medical treatment to folks who need it. And there's some legislative issues that we are not in control of. Is it possible to meet the need as we see it without having additional licensees, even including allowing remote storage?
Commissioner, that's obviously a moving target given the continued increase. I would agree if, again, to my statement of, I don't think we need to add a licensee right here, right now, today. Now, of course, that is a bit of a stilted statement, because even if we start the application process, it's going to take time for us to go through, assess, and reach a decision. Again, potentially how many would be part of that equation. And then they all need ramp-up time to get from, okay, they are now a licensee, to where they are now operating. That could be a 6 to even a 12-month window. And then during that whole period of time, the number of patients is growing. So to try and answer your question, I don't see that we need a new licensee for the current patient population count that we have right now today, but I have to be mindful of what that chart behind you looks like, and that we could get there. And my responsibility being ensuring statewide access, I got to stay in front of it. And so that's the point of trying to take a reasoned approach here, but we still need to get moving.
Right. And of course, any new licensees are responsible, legitimate, law-abiding persons and entities.
Yes, sir. All the background checks and all the same process that have been done before we would do with any new licensees. Okay.
Thank you. As you look at this one that is not producing currently, I think that the recommendation should also include metrics for performance for all licensees moving forward, that if we're going to issue a license, they must meet certain performance operational metrics, if you will, in order to have a license. Otherwise, we will redact that license and issue it to someone else, possibly. I just want to be perfectly clear. We're not going to issue licenses to people who are not in business.
Yes, sir.
Can I add to that? I had a couple of questions in that regard. Are there currently some sort of resolution in our rules that when we have three operators and one quits operating, do we have any objective analysis of that to either withdraw the license or require some sort of, or is it more subjective so that we're just basically working with them, trying to get them back in the saddle?
It is arguably a bit subjective. We do not have a specific rule that says you must fulfill X number of prescriptions or fill X milligrams within a 12-month or 20-month, 4-month period, or their license is suspended or revoked. We do not have that specific type of rule. Now, that said, and this has been discussed internally, the way that the statute is written that talks about they must show capability of being able to dispense and operate, well, the best evidence of that is actually dispensing and operating. And so while, yes, it might be a bit subjective, there would be a time where reasonably they are not producing something equivalent to, you must produce notice on our part, followed by them not even attempting to respond to that. And again, yes, that's an evaluation by my staff. But if we got to that fact pattern, that scenario, then we do feel like we'd have a very strong argument that would be successful on appeal to go ahead and revoke or suspend that license, because they're not showing the capability as required by statute. But there is not that specific rule, as I mentioned.
But the requirement that you mentioned that the legislation has, is that to be awarded a license or to keep a license? My guess is that it would be to be awarded a license. But that would be
You've caught me, Commissioner. I'll have to go back and
I don't know either. So
and I may need to talk with our thankful we have General Counsel Atkins available to help with those types of things, but we can discuss
the statute
that.
Says they must maintain eligibility in order to keep the license. So there's the original eligibility requirements, and those have to be maintained in order to maintain the license.
Okay, that, for eligibility.
Yeah.
But again, there's not some sort of requirement that they are operating at a for a period of time, or if they're down for a period of time. I think that's where our and that's where our inability to do anything about them probably comes up, is that we need some sort of besides us being going in, and granted, we are in a COVID phase too, and I realize that's probably part of the problem here. I get that. But it does show us that we probably need some type of rules on our end that that are very easy for them to measure and say, if you can't do this, then you somebody else is going to get your license.
Yes, ma'am. And we have, and we will continue to discuss that. It is a, we feel it's a little bit difficult because if you put something that's so low, you have to fulfill one prescription or something, that
right.
That's a meaningless rule. At the same time, if you put something that a COVID or something happens with that individual business model to where they come just short for that, you know, they missed
right.
by 10 prescriptions or something, well, now we're either having to work with them and come up with an exception or take a hard line on it and go ahead and take an action when they just came short because of some other factors that we didn't take into consideration. So I absolutely understand your point that putting something in there could be helpful, but I also don't want to have an unintended consequence to it. But we will definitely continue to talk through
that. I agree with that. So where is that particular company? Where was it operating?
They are in Schulenburg.
Okay, so again, we have two operating in the entire state, and they're both in Austin. So,
yes, ma'am.
When we first received the applications, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do we have just a large number of potential operators in Texas, or do we have just maybe two others rather than these three? What's the general amount?
At the time that the original applications were made, I believe there were 39 that
okay.
paid the fee that came in and were looking to be eligible. Since then, I'm aware both Assistant Chief Hester and I have had contact with various multi-state operators that are interested in coming in and wanting to just talk to us about their operation, but clearly are interested in being involved in the program. So there are a lot of entities out there.
I tend to be like some of the other speakers here. I never dreamed I would be sitting or even talking about something that not even saying the initials. But the fact that we do have this legislation, you know, and that we're charged with regulating it and that it's evidently useful to people, I think is really important that we have it as efficient and have it as available as possible. So I applaud you for looking at trying to get the remote storage, if that's possible. I do have a couple other questions. Is that all right? The increase in patients, this one here, this slide here, does that take into consideration either the 80 or the 150? A potential change in the legislature in 2023 to expand the uses?
That does not. You are absolutely correct. That 18-month model has another legislative session smack dab in the middle of it, and this does not account for that because at this point I don't know what the legislative body may come up with.
So it could be higher if they expanded it.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This is basically just extrapolating the current growth.
Yes, ma'am. This is a trajectory based on what we've seen the last 18 months.
Okay. All right. And I had one more. I forgot it. I'll think of it. I'll ask it.
You can call or email me if you can remember it, and I'll be glad to talk about it with you.
I would ask that for the next meeting, you come back with some solid recommendations for the potential expansion of licenses. I would also ask that you bring back a proposal for tightening up the metrics for performance, whether or not these entities are functioning or not. And I understand we can put thresholds, and they may miss the threshold by two or something like that, and perhaps there's a mechanism for the commission to waive that on an extraordinary circumstance that justified why they missed it. Here's why we're going to let them continue. But there has to be performance here, or they cannot have a license. And so I think it's, as a business person, I would like to have some requirements in front of me. If I know I meet those requirements, then I have satisfied the need to have the license. And so I think that it is helpful for those who hold licenses for us to provide them with some baseline expectations for performance. And I think we need to put those in place.
Yes, sir.
I remembered. Okay. There was a mention made of not being able to take credit cards and so therefore hauling large amounts of cash. Explain, where does, is that in the legislation or in our rules?
No, ma'am. My understanding, that's a federal issue because it's still Schedule I narcotic. Banks will not allow financial transactions related to marijuana use.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm not sure I understand if that helps or hurts. If you require all cash transactions, you can't trace them, and tends to be something that certainly criminal elements do a lot of, not that any of our licensees are or applicants are. On the other hand, with electronic transactions, you can trace them and you know who's doing business. So I'm not sure if the cash requirement helps or hurts, that federal requirement. It is a requirement. We've got to abide by it. I understand. But I'm questioning the whether it's a good idea or not.
My understanding is that the licensees, the businesses, would very much like to be able to transact in all the different ways besides cash. And so I think their preference would be that you know, Congress act to take it off Schedule One, and then that then hopefully causes a chain reaction to where banks can allow interactions and they can do business in a more flexible manner.
Thank you for all that information. It's very helpful.
Yes, ma'am.
Look forward to you coming back.
Director Williams, anything to add to that report?
Yes, sir. I have just a couple comments. The I want first to just publicly thank their office for the Regulatory Services Division did a great job overseeing this program. You heard that from some of the licensees and others. They've done a great job navigating some waters that are pretty difficult to navigate. The statute actually requires reasonable statewide access, which is a very specific, you know, that's a pretty nebulous term, right? And they've done a good job of navigating that. So I just wanted to commend them for that. There are a lot of ways to get to reasonable statewide access. Many of the people that spoke today and others will have an opinion about how we get there. We'd like to obviously engage the partners that are involved in this and doing that. I think that's a good idea so that we include their voice. And lastly, Commissioner Blair, to your point about those that are dispensing, we collectively agree that a dispensing organization should, by definition, dispense. And so we are definitely on the same page with that. We'll have some recommendations to solve that problem as we come back. But I think the advisory council would be helpful to have someone weigh in on this, aside from just us, because it affects their business. And so we want to make sure that we include them.
Well, and it was, to your point, it was particularly impressive to have every side of the equation say that we're doing a great job. You guys are doing a great job. So that you don't find that very often. Usually there's an outlier.
Thank you, ma'am. Yeah, it's the staff in RSD, and I will definitely pass that along to them. Thank you.
I do like the idea of an advisory council, and if you would bring back a proposal for
I definitely will
for how that might be.
Additionally, Chief Mueller mentioned the other states that have done this. There have been a lot of mistakes made. And we do not have to touch every hot stove. We can take, you know, some lessons from them. And that advisory council, there may be some good use of the Canner Association and so on that could save us some missteps where others have made mistakes. And we should definitely leverage that relationship.
I concur. Advisory council would be a great idea. And I also want to, again, pat Chief, you and your assistant and your whole staff on the back. You're obviously thinking about the things that are important, planning on them, and we'll look forward to seeing some concrete additional guidelines and rules at the next commission meeting.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Chief, thank you for your report, and we look forward to seeing you in October on this subject.
Yes, sir.
Moving on to our next item on the agenda, under Section 8B, New Business, Report Discuss and Possible Action on the Health, Physical Fitness, and Command Presence Policy. Turn it over to Captain Greg Davis, Michael Harper, and Deputy Director Freeman Martin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we are going to share with you an update and a briefing on the physical fitness testing and command presence evaluation for the fiscal year. And I'll turn over the mic over to Program Supervisor Michael Harper, Fitness and Wellness Unit.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. As an update to the program to maintain compliance with Texas Government Code 614.172 and the agency health, physical fitness, and command presence policy in DPS General Manual 8.14, provides employees with 5 different test options for demonstrating compliance with physical fitness testing and requires a minimum score of 70% or higher. Additionally, employees are provided with 3 different pathways to demonstrate compliance with the command presence policy and includes the waist circumference, height and weight, as well as a 3rd pathway through percent body fat. Aggregate data and data within each component was analyzed for potential discrepancies, disparities, and impact of groups, as we'll see in each one of these reports. For looking at the physical fitness testing for the spring 2022 cycle, aggregate data indicated a compliance rate for the spring period of 99.60% in compliance. The compliance rate within the fall 2021 was 99.5, an increase for us from the previous cycle. Data also indicated that 71.73% of the population surpassed the minimum requirements and achieved the 80th percentile or higher. 28.35% of the population, 1,122 individuals, achieved the 90th percentile or higher. All the data was analyzed for potential discrepancies, disparities, and impact on a variety of groups, including gender, age, race, location, and division. Additionally, the data was reviewed while looking at the interaction of multiple factors from any of these listed. The analysis indicated no differences of significance within any of the aforementioned comparisons on the physical fitness testing. During the physical fitness testing, individuals in the spring period are offered a waiver for if individuals have medical issues such as pregnancy, if individuals have items as medical concerns of surgeries, or if they have deployment due to military. 1.8% of the agency received a waiver per the guidance from the Texas DPS General Manual 8.14, providing an exemption from it. 57 of those were males and 17 were female. During the spring 2022 evaluation period, 60.69% of the agency, 2,402 individuals, earned an exemption and were considered in compliance. Individuals are able to earn an exemption by demonstrating compliance with a command presence during the fall cycle and a physical fitness test score of 80% or higher during the fall period as well. Moving on to the command presence components. For the spring 2022 cycle, the command presence evaluation aggregate data indicated that 95.6% of all commissioned officers of Texas DPS were in compliance with the command presence policy through one of the 3 different pathways to compliance. In the fall 2019 evaluation period, there was 94.8% of the agency in compliance, demonstrating an improvement since the last evaluation period. Just as the physical fitness testing data was analyzed for potential discrepancies, disparities, and impact on a variety of groups, the command presence evaluation data was also analyzed within the same means. As seen in the comparison of males and females, the compliance rate had minimal differences between groups where adequate sample size was present. There was no differences of significance with any of the comparisons with adequate sample size. In this demonstration, males demonstrated a compliance rate of 95.8% and females demonstrated a compliance rate of 92.8%. Both groups improved compliance rates from the previous cycle, where males and females had a compliance rate of 95.1 and 91.5 respectively. Of the small percentage that are not in compliance within each group, 19% of males and 4.5% of females are within 2 inches of being in compliance in looking at just tier 1 and very close in the other 2 tiers as well. Following the spring 2022 testing cycle, individuals not in compliance were provided with training via a fitness improvement plan. During this training initiative provided to these individuals, research-based research-based recommendations related to physical fitness, health, and nutrition that is within the scope of the plan administrator is provided to the participant. As a result of these initiatives conducted by Fitness Wellness Unit staff, as well as the majority of them administered by DPS Fitness Institute graduates, numerous individuals came into compliance. Previously, there were 224 individuals that were not in compliance when looking at all three tiers to obtain compliance, whereas during the spring 2022 evaluation period, there was a demonstrated marked improvement and now 175 individuals outside of these thresholds. When considering the risk and unfortunate health disparities within law enforcement, they're well known. However, policies like those discussed related to the physical fitness testing and command presence policy are making a positive impact to help ensure commissioned officers within Texas DPS are fit for duty and, more importantly, fit for life as well. The physical fitness policy and command presence policy impact each commissioned officer, but is described in the 21st century recommendations from the Presidential's task force, with the sixth pillar being all about officer safety and wellness. It goes beyond this as it states their wellness and safety are crucial for them, their colleagues, and their agencies, as well as the well-being of the communities. There are numerous testimonies of the impact of these policies that have been received and mentioned by those individuals of the impact of not only themselves, but also on their family and those around them, similar to what was quoted within the 21st century recommendations time and time again. This first one comes from an individual within here in the capital area, here in Central Texas, and was an individual placed on the fitness improvement plan. Initially had difficulties with consistency with the plan. Further on in continuing the plan, continuing to meet with the individual, now logs exercise, and now feels very accomplished. As he stated, he's now able to complete a 10-mile walk without being winded, whereas at the beginning he was winded after 1 to 2 miles. He stated he now avoids chips and soda while at work and is excited to bring healthier options. Recently sent his plan administrator a photo of his new lunchbox. Lost 11 pounds in just over 2 months of making small changes, and is just one of the testimonies. From the Ranger Division, there's an individual that was in compliance, yet following the same pathway, individuals that are in compliance as well as individuals that are not in compliance have the same resources afforded to them of reaching out to Fitness Institute graduates for assistance. He shared a self-concern over his appearance and nutrition and fitness levels. After learning his personal goals, what type of exercise he enjoys, what meal preference, there was guidance provided through easy-to-follow weekly fitness routines based on his goals and general nutritional information. Since implementing this plan, he stated that he has seen a visible improvement and stated how proud he is of his accomplishments. And another trooper from out of the South Texas region, this individual was also an individual that was in compliance, but stated he was shocked when he was assessed and was measured at 41 inches at his waist. He stated that he was on the verge of being non-compliant with standards and indicated that he was tired, had chronic back problems, and struggled to fit in his uniform. He then modified his diet and began a fitness routine led by DPS Fitness Institute graduates and working out with several other DPS troopers and supervisors. With gradual results, he lost over 25 pounds and has now slimmed down to a 35-inch waist and stated his overall health has improved and he feels much better. And one last one that I have that I was not able to include in the slides, I received late yesterday. This is from down in the San Antonio area from the Central Texas region. This is an individual that was on a fitness improvement plan due to non-compliance on the command presence policy. When he started that plan, he weighed at 285 pounds and had a 51-inch waist. He started doing workouts, and as his confidence grew, he expanded the workouts and continued to expand what he was doing in those workouts. When he was first working out with a Fitness Institute graduate, following those exercises, he would lay on the ground, worn out. Now he gets up and is ready for more. The individual now works out on his own at Orange Theory and has stated he's competing against others that he never thought he would ever do before starting this plan. His spouse also works out with him, and recently they did their first 5K together. He has lost 47 pounds and is now at 238 from starting out at 285 pounds and lost 8.5 inches at the waist at 42.5, where he was at 51 inches prior. While the testimonials could go on and on, The main point is that these policies are making a positive impact on the agency, individual officers, families, and the communities that are served. Thank you for your time and appreciate your support of the agency.
Thank you. Director Martin.
Chairman, Commissioners, Freeman Martin, Deputy Director of Homeland Security Operations. In October of 2019, the Commission adopted the current version of the physical fitness testing and command presence policy, which added the command presence requirement. To provide time for employees to adapt to the new standards and allow for the collection of data regarding the program, the Commission adopted an implementation schedule, which provided temporary notifications to the requirements. Due to the pandemic, the implementation schedule was extended twice to allow for the data collection from two consecutive cycles. The fall of 2021 and the spring of 2022, the two consecutive cycles were completed and showed an overall improvement in both the physical fitness and the command presence for commissioned employees, as was just shown there from Michael Harper, at 99.6% in compliance on the physical fitness and 95.6% in compliance agency-wide for the commissioned population for command presence. So that brings us to today. At this time, we're going to propose three modifications to the policy that was passed in October of 2019. The first one is to account for the variation in taking of the measurements. We propose that the amended policy apply the 2% allowance to each command presence standard. Number two, the mandatory consequences for failing to meet the command presence standards will continue to consist of mandatory fitness education, which requires the placement on a fitness improvement plan, a FIP. And in certain circumstances, that can result in a performance improvement plan also. So number two is that we propose that the policy be amended so that failures to meet the command presence standard alone will not preclude participation in the promotional process and secondary employment. So that's number two. And then number three, finally, we propose that the policy be amended so that the failure of the command presence requirement alone will not result in the temporary assignment to a non-commissioned role, non-law enforcement role, and preclude overtime. So at this time, we propose that the commission adopt these three proposed amendments to the policy that was passed in October 2019, and the agency move forward with the full implementation of the health, physical fitness, and command presence policy.
Is there a motion?
I'll move that that was just laid out. I don't want to repeat it because I didn't follow it, but that will. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, I'll move that we adopt those changes.
Okay. Sorry. We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Stanchel to adopt the recommendations as laid out by Director Martin. Is there any discussion?
One question. Do you know what DPSOA's thoughts are about the modifications?
I think they're listening to a very small minority. The comments that we have are even those who are in compliance, those are, you know, that are extremely fit, don't support the very small percentage of the agency that is not. I mean, you see how many are in compliance, right, and the testimonials are just endless. We get them all the time. But, you know, for instance, the comment about the pregnancy that resulted in the failure, the commission the policy, pregnancy policy for commissioned employees, and also the physical fitness policy for pregnant employees allows for waivers, many waivers that are used. We see those all the time. So I really have no idea what he was referring to.
Is it during pregnancy or post?
Both. Well? There's and I would refer to Michael Harper just commented on the number of waivers that were granted, 1.6%. Mm-hmm. Of the commission population or were on waivers this last testing cycle?
Specific to your question in reference to the waivers, the waiver does a lot for individuals while they're pregnant as well as postpartum for those individuals. And within the policy, it does state that individuals that are pregnant or postpartum are eligible for a 12-month waiver, which can be extended with approval from chain of command. So those individuals, as they are coming back, do have the opportunity for them for that to be extended for the duration that is needed for to bring them back into compliance.
But during that extension, you would not be eligible to be considered for promotional, for example?
If they are on a waiver, they are considered in compliance.
Okay, thank you.
So then, Deputy Freeman, is it obviously DPS is a premier law enforcement organization and will continue to be so. And for that to happen, we've got to have commissioned officers and non-commissioned folks who can do their job physically as well as mentally and at an excellent level. Is it fair to say that considering the concerns we heard this morning, the need to get the job done right, that you've considered all that and these recommendations take all that under consideration?
Yes, sir, absolutely. And everything we've done is this is not meant to be punitive. This is all about the wellness and health of the employees and their physical fitness to do the performance of the job. And we have over 140 of our current employees that have graduated from the Physical Fitness Institute that are now spread throughout the state that are helping those that are not in compliance becoming the ones that are on the fitness improvement plans. In addition to just in Texas, I can't tell you how many agencies that are following our model as we speak. And then on the national level, our problem is not having enough employees in the fitness and wellness unit to keep up with the demands for presentations through IACP and the International Police Chiefs organizations to do these presentations to show what we're doing here in Texas and how it's held up in court cases, for example, with the Lubbock Police Department. Them using our model and withstanding scrutiny.
Thank you.
We have a motion on the floor to approve the recommendations to the command presence policy as outlined by Deputy Director Martin. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you. Captain Davis, Michael Harper, and Deputy Director Martin. Appreciate it. Next item on the agenda, item 8, new business, section C, report discussion and possible action on the fiscal year 2023 internal operating budget. That'll be presented by Chief Susie Whittington. Chief.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Your mic's not on.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Susie Whittington, Chief Financial Officer. So I'm here to present the fiscal year 23 operating budget. As you know, fiscal year runs from September through August. And in putting together the 23 budget, it's very similar to the 22 budget. So I'll keep this brief. We always start with the General Appropriations Act. As you can see, this slide shows the total amount appropriated by the legislature for fiscal year 23, and that total is just under $1.4 billion. We had to make some adjustments to that amount due to some federal funds that we no longer expect to receive, and so that gets us down to just around $1.2 billion. So on the next slide, this is the budget by strategy, which is how the legislature appropriates our funding. And the first column is the budget exactly as it appears in the Appropriations Act, which was Senate Bill 1. The middle column shows the federal funds adjustments that I just mentioned. And then the last column is the net of adjustments that is equal to our operating budget by strategy. The next slide shows the type of funds that are in make up our budget. Over 90% is funded with general revenue. We also have $15 million in general revenue dedicated funds, which are funds that can only be used for specific purposes. We now have about $35 million in federal funds, which is a big decrease from back when we had TDEM as part of our agency. And the rest of the budget is funded with appropriated receipts, which are funds that we collect and are allowed to keep and spend, as well as state grants and interagency contracts. The next slide shows how the budget breaks out between types of expenditures, and you can see that our budget's made up mostly of costs to pay the staff. Salary costs make up 71%, and the rest is operating costs, capital purchases, rent, professional fees, fuel, supplies, utilities, and so on. And this budget includes 11,388 positions. Next slide. There are seized funds in our budget. We have both federal and state seized funds. We usually budget the federal seized funds up front at the beginning of the year to pay for part of the annual lease on our handheld radios and also for some intercept equipment used by CID. These are the same items we have funded with federal seized funds for several years. And then for the state seized funds, we estimate we're going to collect about $800,000 during the year, and we just put a placeholder in the budget for those. And what we'll do is come back to you later, probably in the spring, and ask your permission to spend those on law enforcement equipment as recommended by the directors. But for right now, the state seized funds would just be a placeholder. And last year we spent some of the seized funds on handguns, and you all gave us permission to do that. So we'll come back with a recommendation later on how to spend the rest of those funds. And with that, I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
Any questions for Chief Whittenden?
Okay.
You're seeking action on?
Yes, we would need an approval.
I'll move approval.
I'll second the motion.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to approve the fiscal year 2023 internal operating budget. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. And you're on for our next item, which is the report, discussion, and possible action on the 2024-25 legislative appropriations request, including exceptional items.
Thank you. Again, I'm Susie Whittenden, Chief Financial Officer. So it's time for agencies to submit their requests for appropriations for the next biennium, as you said, fiscal years 24 and 25. This is our base budget. This is which is $2.9 billion, including all of our funds. And you can see that general revenue is $2.7 billion. This is basically equal to the appropriations that we have in the current biennium, less any one-time items that they take out. Sometimes the legislature asks us to take a cut to our base budget, but there was no request for a cut this time. And these amounts are worked out between us and the governor's office and the legislative budget board. So we've agreed to this as our base budget. And then anything that comes in over and above, or that we request over and above this amount, is an exceptional item. And the directors have recommended 5 exceptional items, totaling $1.3 billion and an additional 1,711 positions for your consideration. And I'll go over each one of these items separately. And if you have any questions, feel free to jump in and ask at any time. So the first
one. I would like to start just with one thing, don't mind, okay. Susie, but obviously that's a lot of money. And it's a tremendous amount of money. And there's only so much money available, and certainly the state legislatures have, and the governor has, lieutenant governor has, to appropriate to state agencies. We're mindful of that. But at the same point, we feel obligated to ask for those things that are necessary to do our job and what we've been asked to do. And that's one of the requests. And a lot of this money you'll see embedded into this is not just positions, which certainly is cost, but for facilities. And we've long talked about the need for regional headquarters in certain places, and also the need for a state-of-the-art academy in Williamson County. So that's some of the larger cost items, but that our chief financial officer will be able to break down.
Thank you. So on the next slide, this is our first item. We're calling it Protect Texas. There are a lot of components in this item. starting with the law enforcement communications. We have an aging infrastructure for our communications towers and our radio system, and we need to replace the end-of-life towers and set up a regular maintenance cost, maintenance cycle for the towers. We already, right now, have over 25 of our towers are over 40 years old. That's about 20% of all the towers. And they pose a safety risk being that old. So we need funding for our radios as well, which will reach end of life in December of 2023. Our vehicle costs have continued to rise, resulting in less buying power for vehicles. So without additional funding for our vehicles, we'll be purchasing about 100 fewer vehicles in the next biennium. We normally buy about 1,700 in a two-year period. For safety, we need to replace our aircraft on a 15-year cycle, and we're not meeting that. So we're asking to replace two of our aging helicopters and one Cessna, and that Cessna's already 17 years old now. Due to the increase in the volume of state travel, we are not reimbursing our staff as quickly as we'd like to. So we're asking for a travel voucher system that would automate a lot of the process and make it more efficient and speed up the reimbursements to our staff, who they pay for the travel up front with their own funds. As the state has grown in population, the need for law enforcement has grown proportionately. So we're asking to add 250 law enforcement positions, including in Highway Patrol, CID, Rangers, and Executive Protection Bureau, along with the support personnel that come with those positions. We're also asking to upgrade our law enforcement technology for training. It's more practical and realistic. Virtual reality simulators are very important. They also need upgraded equipment like for their tasers, cloud storage for the videos, and driving simulators. As you know, we provide safety and security for the state buildings in the Capitol complex as well as at the state capitol. The security personnel who routinely perform that task are very understaffed, so we've been filling in with commissioned troopers, and that's probably not the best use of our trooper personnel. So that gap, we're asking to fill that gap with 50 additional security specialists. They're non-commissioned. There are 5 recruit schools in our base, but the cost of running those recruit schools has increased quite a bit due to the pay raises and so on. So we're asking for that incremental cost, the increased cost of that 600 recruits can be trained over the next biennium. In order to prevent and protect against threats, we're asking for some additional personnel, primarily criminal intelligence analysts, data scientists, GIS specialists, along with some CID agents, so we can proactively identify threats and follow up on suspicious activity that's been reported to us. And the last piece of this request is to increase the security at the DPS headquarters by putting in a perimeter fence, like many governments have throughout the country. An open campus creates an access risk to both our data and to our staff. The security fencing, if we had security fencing, it would hinder the probability of premeditated attacks or damage to our facilities and statewide operations. The second item is for driver's license resources to accommodate the steady growth in the Texas population. The call center is understaffed and has been for some time, and therefore we're not able to answer the calls and the emails. And the volume continues to increase 4 to 5% every year. So we're asking for both technology improvements and staff to address that problem. For improvement to the timeliness of getting a driver license appointment, the staff looked at what it would take to be able to provide an appointment within 60 days. And based on that analysis, it'll take 587 positions and 10 additional driver license offices. They looked at various different scenarios and thought that this was the best option to request. And then the third part of this driver license request is to the state-to-state program to so we'd be Real ID compliant. The third request is our largest, which is for construction and repair of our buildings. DPS has 360 facilities which require maintenance, and some now require outright replacement. So 2 years ago, we contracted to do a facilities condition assessment, and that assessment identified over $230 million of needed repairs. We're just asking for $30 million for the biennium so that we can address the most critical deferred maintenance projects and to avoid office closures and service disruptions. We also need to upgrade the generators and expand redundant power generation capacity. We have some new construction requests that include an El Paso regional headquarters. Also, we're asking for increased aircraft hangar capacity, water treatment needs at the training academy, and crime lab enhancement at headquarters, and some smaller building updates, including an equine facility. Improvements to security enhancements and equipment needs include cameras and electronic access at all of our buildings. And then the largest item that we're requesting that the director mentioned is to address the need for significant increased training for law enforcement. And that would be for not just DPS law enforcement, but all any Texas law enforcement officers. Because our current facility really can't accommodate the increase that's needed. So we need a larger facility that would include live threat engagement training, which is a critical need for law enforcement. This facility would provide the ability to conduct realistic training and would consist of a two-story tactical training house with multi-entry points and rooms capable of situational reconfiguration so that they can train in different scenarios. It would be fully enclosed to allow for low light and night vision goggle training day or night. Additionally, it would include dormitories and support facilities. And we propose building this in three phases, taking 6 years, because the cost of the entire project is estimated to be $1.4 billion. So phase one is what we would request now. It would cost $466 million. And phase one would include the site infrastructure, utilities, firing range baffling, dorms for the recruits, kitchen and cafeteria, classroom building, indoor-outdoor physical fitness facility, and then additional phases in future years would provide it more infrastructure for SWAT offices, in-service dorms, classrooms, canine facility, and offices for the drone program and the vehicle program. The next item is the fourth is a request for crime lab activities. So due to the previous funding from the legislature, the sexual assault kits and the blood alcohol analysis backlogs have been eliminated. And so now the crime labs are turning their focus to toxicology. And that's where the largest backlog exists today, and funding's needed to accelerate the forensic testing of drugs and toxicology. The crime labs processed over 140,000 information requests in 2021, and they continue to develop new testing methods to address the implementation of things like the Texas Hemp Act. So funding is sought due to inflationary impact also on consumable prices. And then the last bullet there, the Forensic Laboratory Discovery Portal. The addition of this portal would allow for consistent and efficient access to lab records, which would improve compliance with the Michael Morton Act, eliminate records release errors that can overturn cases on appeal, and ensure affirmative and proactive compliance with this part of the criminal justice process. And DPS would operate and maintain that portal that would be used by all accredited forensic labs in Texas. And our final item is for IT and cybersecurity funding. This item includes replacing end-of-life IT infrastructure, such as laptops or laptops that can't run Windows 11. Also, other equipment like switches, licenses, and other devices. Currently, the agency has 52 legacy applications that have to be rewritten to eliminate the risk of failure and cyber attacks. And we have a need for an enterprise metadata management tool that would provide a unified data governance solution and improve our data security. And we've not been specifically funded for cybersecurity, so we need funding for the staffing and equipment to improve the network, the security of the network, so that we can operate at capacity, worry-free of cyber intrusions. We also need to fund our cyber response team who assists police stations that have had a cyber attack. And those are all of the exceptional items. Happy to take questions, and also the division chiefs are here to answer anything that is in particular to any of their areas.
Thank you, Susie, for that report. I know I've had a number of conversations with the director and the deputies about these requests. You know, it's always difficult to ask for everything that we need to be backfilled, but we have a lot of needs, and I feel confident that these are reasonable and appropriate requests for the department to be making. So thank you for all the work that's been done to sharpen the pencil.
Thank you.
Any questions? I would entertain, Director, you have any comments to make?
No, sir.
Okay. I would entertain a motion to approve the 2024-2025 legislative appropriations request, including exceptional items.
I so move.
Is there a second? We have a motion from Commissioner Wainwright and a second from Commissioner Stauchill to approve the 2024-2025 legislative appropriations request, including exceptional items. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda, 8, new business, section E, report, discussion, possible action regarding the proposed FY 2023 Chief Auditor's Office internal audit strategy presented by Chief Catherine Melvin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Actually, good afternoon.
Or good afternoon. Good morning. For the record, Catherine Melvin, Chief Auditor, Chairman, Commissioners, Directors, at your places in blue is the proposed fiscal year 2023 proposed internal audit strategy, of which I am seeking your approval today. This annual strategy, also known as the audit plan, is required under both professional auditing standards and the Texas Internal Auditing Act. And we appreciate this opportunity to present our vision of the internal audit efforts for the coming year. I'd like to start with maybe a look back first. Let's kind of look at some of our accomplishments in FY22 and just see how we spent our time related to the plan you approved this time last year. The Chief Auditor's Office, like all internal audit functions, primarily provides two types of services. One is assurance, or you might think of them as traditional audits, but also internal auditors by definition provide advisory services, also known as consulting services. Between the two, it's a balance, it's a bit of a mix. I would say at DPS we tend to spend a little more of our time on the advisory side of services. Chairman, I know you and I had discussed that early on to say, what is the best use of your internal audit function and where can we be more proactive? Next slide. So let's look at the internal audit strategy that you approved last year. It's a lot of typing on here, but if you look kind of on the upper left side, you'll see the strategies or the focus for the internal audit function that you approved last year. So you see financial controls and processes, IT, law enforcement support, licensing and regulatory services, critical infrastructure, and then from there on, you're going to see more routine internal audit efforts, including administrative efforts as well. So next slide. This is meant to be more of a visual to kind of look at, okay, let's look at some of the projects we completed. And did we tick off, did we spend time in those areas that you approved? So as you recall, this is more of a strategy. We're not approving necessarily a standing list of audits that will accomplish throughout the year, but to ensure that we're spending our time in those areas that are focused and of highest risk. So you can see these are some of our completed projects. The next slide will show some projects still in progress. We are closing out some of these projects, but some of these will continue on into the new fiscal year. But you can see we spent time and covered each of those strategic areas. Next slide. It's important to also consider the work of external auditors. DPS is subject to a number of external audits as well. The State Auditor's Office, you can see they were here quite a bit, and some other reviewing entities too. Typically those reports, most of those reports I do believe come to the commissioners, certainly the State Auditor's Office reports do as well. So I like to consider both internal and external audits and reviews as we think about the assurances that are provided. All right. Next slide. The FY22 annual report is a formal report that will summarize all of our efforts. That is due by the end of October or due November 1st. So you will be receiving that as you have in years past. The format and the content is prescribed by the State Auditor's Office, so we're a little limited in what we can put in the report, but we will follow those requirements, and you will have that by the end of October. Okay. All right, so let's look ahead. This is the plan that's before you today. For FY23, we're proposing to look in some a few slight changes. You see financial controls and processes again, information resources, of course. But we switched out some of our buckets that we wanted to focus on. We picked up procurement and contract management. It's an area we've looked at and spent some time in the past, and we thought it might be good to come back and provide more assistance in that area, asset management and critical infrastructure, and then personnel management. And I think it's very timely that at the same time you're approving the operating budget and the LAR, particularly the exceptional items for the agencies, to see that your internal audit function is also focused on some of these critical risk areas. What we've seen is that, of course, the department has, this whole morning has been, you see very dedicated individuals that do their jobs. But like many state agencies or most state agencies, it's a challenge as the state grows. And do we have the resources to support that? And it's not always our direct operations, but the support functions, I think, that are there to help people ensure the mission is achieved. Okay, next slide. This is just another, I think I had a similar graphic like this last year, just to kind of see the different buckets that we're looking at. As you see, there are some routine efforts. There's some administrative things that we do every year, including some mandatory activities, our coordination of external reviews as well, and then the four areas that we're proposing, or five areas we're proposing in the coming year. You notice that one off to the side, emerging risks. That is intended to allow for some flexibility in our plan, that something the director has requested of us to ensure that as things arise during the year, that we have some capacity to address them and we have some flexibility too, and they always do. It's obviously a very dynamic environment that we work in, and so we want to ensure that our internal audit function is responsive. Okay. And then looking ahead, we are starting the efforts to undergo an assessment of ourselves. This is the answers the question of who audits the auditors. We will be audited, and peer, another internal audit director at another state agency, and a team will be coming to review us. Commissioners, you'll receive some communications about that. Directors, you will as well. It's required every 3 years by every internal audit function that follows audit standards, and so we're no different. We'll undergo that review. Staffing is something we are watching closely as we look ahead. We have some vacancies. We are looking to fill those and ensure that we have, you know, good, you know, highly qualified individuals on our team. And then each year we pick up some initiatives. I don't know what those will look like this year, but as a team we'll work together and focus our efforts on probably a few key initiatives to kind of focus our efforts going forward. And that is all I have to present for you. This is an action item, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
A couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the report, Ms. Melvin. Thank you for you and your office for all you do. You do a very accomplished job. You and I have met, talked several times about the strategy for the next fiscal year. And we met mid-year to talk about the update for the commission. I think we'll probably do the same thing in the coming year. Do you have the resources you feel like you need to do the job that we need with the Chief Auditor's Office?
I do. I did mention we have some vacancies that we are working to fill. It's a challenging environment. It's a pretty common topic among my peers, most certainly. I think we're all fighting over the same resources that are out there. But yes, I do feel we're adequately staffed to meet this plan.
And obviously, the audit strategy takes a big picture view of the agency. The agency's priorities and critical functions are considered. You consider any input from the commissioners and working with the management of the department. But you can't cover everything every year in an audit. What things are not covered in this strategy and why?
That's, good question. That we consider a wide range of risk in various projects as we go through a risk assessment process to land on this plan. But it is true, we cannot, the plan does not and cannot cover all risks for the agency. So it's really important, I think, to understand the limitations of the internal audit coverage that we have and the limitations of the available resources, of course. But management is responsible for their systems of internal control. And that's really our job, is to come and assist them with ensuring, you know, do those controls help you meet your objectives? So, yes, you know, we can't cover all risk, but the plan proposed to you is intended to focus on those areas that we think our resources could be of best use to the commissioners and to management.
Okay. I don't have any other questions, Mr. Chairman.
I do have a question. Okay. One of the last things you mentioned were the initiatives.
Yes.
And those aren't determined yet, but there are throughout the 2023 year, right? Yes. How do they, are they arrived at internally, and do they come up throughout the year, or is it, I mean, as things present themselves, or how does that work?
Yes. I would say all of that, yes.
Thank you.
There's some initiatives, I think, that comes from the team. There are some things, I think, that they identify. One thing that's important to us is to work together to assess risks from the agency. So from the most junior staff to our most senior staff, we are working together to go through that risk assessment process, because it's a good way to ensure that you're very plugged in and your understanding of the organization that you work for. So out of that can come initiatives from our team itself, but also I think in just working with the different divisions, with the managers and the division chiefs, that there's requests that come through that as well.
Okay. Thank you. That makes sense.
I just want to thank you as our direct report and your your division for the work that you do on behalf of the department. It's always timely and spot on, and I do appreciate that. I appreciate Commissioner Wainwright working with you as the liaison from the commission to audit
permanent
his efforts as well.
Permanent liaison.
Yes. She said permanent liaison. So. but thank you as well. So you're looking for approval of this strategy, correct, Commissioner?
Yes, and I so move, Mr. Chairman.
I'll second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Wainwright and a second from Commissioner Blair to accept the proposed FY 2023 Chief Auditor's Office Internal Audit Strategy. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Commissioners. Appreciate that.
Next item on the agenda, Section 8, New Business, Item F, Final Determination in Contested Cases, Consideration of Possible Action on Proposals for Decision, SOA Docket Number 405-22-1689.PSB, Irving Brian Cabrera Tejada. General Counsel Adkins.
Phil Adkins, General Counsel. We have one contested case coming to you today for final determination. The case comes from the private security program. The department suspended the alarm system installer license of Irving Tejada based upon pending charges for the felony offense of assault of a security officer. The department's adopted rules regarding offenses that will lead to a license denial, and assault of a security officer is one of those so designated offenses. Mr. Tejada appealed the department's decision to the State Office of Administrative Hearings. After an evidentiary hearing, the administrative law judge issued a proposal for decision affirming the department's decision. Today, I'm asking you to adopt the ALJ's proposal for decision as your final determination in this matter.
Is there a motion?
Yes, I move.
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Wainwright and a second from Commissioner Stodgill to affirm the decision under Section 8, New Business, Item F1, SOA Docket Number 405-22-1689.PSB in the case of Irving Brian Cabrera Tejada. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you. Next on the agenda, Item 8, New Business G, Report Discussion Possible Action on the Following Rule Proposals for Publication to Receive Public Comment. First three items will be handled by Chief Sherry Gibson. Chief Gibson.
Good morning. Sherry Gibson, Chief Driver License Division. We have three rules that need proposed changes. The first one is 15.58, and this is modifying the criteria used for submitting commercial driver license applicants to the Medical Advisory Board in accordance with Texas Transportation Code 521.142E1 and to comply with Federal Register Notice FR845549 related to commercial drivers with insulin-treated diabetes mellitus. The second one is Rule 15.181, and amending this rule will allow us to comply with Texas Election Code related to the eligibility for an election identification certificate. Currently, that the statute allows them to use an expired DL or ID for 4 years instead of 60 days. So we'll be updating that language. The third one is 16.5 regarding Texas CDL vision waiver requirements. Amending this rule updates the rule to align Texas CDL vision waiver requirements with the revisions made by FMCSA to 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 391. It eliminates the need for Texas to process a Texas vision waiver. DL is requesting approval for posting items 8G1, 8G2, and 8G3 in the Texas Register.
So moved.
And I second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to publish for public comment in the Texas Register under Section 8 new business items G, 1, 2, and 3 as posted in our agenda. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Chief. We'll see you in a minute. Items 4 and 5 under G, Chief Orlando Alanese will handle those.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. I just had a couple of proposals as well. They're specific to the Title 37 of the Texas Administrative Code, Rule Number 21.2. Is specific to the standards of vehicle safety and the, as it speaks of vehicle lamps, reflective devices, and associated equipment, it just specifies that any aftermarket and modifications to these lamps and those items listed in that code, that they also coincide with the rule, and they can't deviate from the 108 standards of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. That's Rule 21.2, and 21.3 is specific to sunscreening and privacy window devices, also known as the tent law. Just trying to clear up the language that is inconsistent with Transportation Code 547613, and just trying to clarify the language for make it easier for law enforcement in the administering that law.
So in order, or in other words, when a window is too darkly tinted, this can clear up whether or not that's an issue or not.
That's exactly right. There's a couple of different ones on here that are listed specific to like side glass windows. There should not be any tint, and there's just some inconsistencies in the two different administrative code and the transportation code. I'm trying to clarify that. So also asking for consideration to be added into registration, into registry.
I'd entertain a motion on items 4 and 5 under G, new business.
So moved.
And I second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to publish for public comment in the Texas Register items 4 and 5 under Section G of new business. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Chief. Item H, intelligence threat briefing. We will handle that in executive session. Under item 9, ongoing business report discussion, possible adoption of the following previously published rule proposed. Actually, we have just one for Chief Sherry Gibson. Proposed amendments to 37 TAC section 16.31 concerning third-party skills and knowledge testing program. Chief Gibson.
Hi, Sherry Gibson, Chief Driver License Division. Amendment to 16.31 was posted in the Texas Register. This updates the language that allows third-party skills testers to administer both the skills test and the knowledge test. There were no comments received, so we recommend adoption.
I move we adopt.
And I second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to adopt amendments to 37 TAC section 16.31 concerning third-party skills and knowledge testing program. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Chief. Item B, report discussion, possible action regarding the modification of the DPS organizational structure and the appointment, promotion, ratification, unemployment, evaluation, reassignment, duties, discipline, or dismissal of a member of the department or commission management team. Director McCraw, do you have anything?
Yes, sir. Chairman, commissioners, as you're aware, certainly we lost one of our regional directors to retirement earlier today. Todd Snyder will be retiring at the end of this month. And also Brian Brzezinski, the assistant chief of the Texas Rangers Division. So we have two positions. It requires the advice and consent of the commission to approve. And at this time, I'd like to seek the commission's approval to appoint the position of the assistant Texas Ranger position to Corey Lane, who is currently a major assigned to the Central Texas region, to the new, and make him or promote him to the new assistant chief position, Texas Ranger Division.
I'd entertain a motion.
I'll move. Do we need to approve? Is that the
yes, proper? Approving the director's recommendation.
And I second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to approve the director's recommendation of the promotion of Corey Lane to the position of Assistant Chief of the Texas Rangers.
Thank you, sir. He's here today if you'd like to give him any instructions or threaten him. He has an opportunity to do so.
First things first, we need to approve him. So
yes, sir.
We have a motion. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Congratulations, Corey.
The second position with Todd Snyder's retirement is Regional Director in Central Texas Region. We have another vacancy, and we're recommending that Major Vincent Luciano of the Criminal Investigative Division in the North Texas Region be promoted to the Regional Director position of Central Texas.
I move approval.
And I second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Blair and a second from Commissioner Wainwright to approve for the promotion of Vincent Luciano to the position of Regional Director for Central Texas.
Yes, sir.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Congratulations, Regional Director. Are there any commission members wishing to give a report? Moving on, item 10B. Chief Whittington, you've already given us an extensive report. Do you have anything else for us? No. And Chief Auditor's Office, Catherine Melvin, as well. Any division status reports or activities?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Directors. My name is Brady Mills. I'm the Chief of the Crime Laboratory Division. And we'd like to brief this afternoon regarding our seized drug case reduction plan. This is Alice Hamelot, one of our assistant lab directors. I will pass the mic.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the last 5 years of our seized drugs program, some of the challenges that we've been faced with in the forensic community, some ways we've pivoted, and the small wins that have led to significant gains in our fight against our backlog. To remind everyone, a backlog occurs when the demand for forensic services exceeds our ability to meet that demand. It's not unusual, and backlogs are occurring nationwide in forensic science. In 2017, we were faced with a backlog of approximately 6,700 seized drugs cases. A backlog in this discipline is defined as any case that hasn't been worked in the lab in 30 days. So the numbers that you see in front of you on the blue tiles are the number of cases older than 30 days awaiting testing at the end of that calendar year. So in the first year of this project, it more than doubled. Our demand for forensic services, it increased through 2020. And then we started to see some small wins from our efforts, and we're making progress. If you talk to our forensic scientists in seized drugs and you ask them what is the single most impactful challenge you faced in the last 5 years, they will talk about the Federal Hemp Act and the subsequent Texas Hemp Act that was passed in the 86th legislature that changed how we have to analyze our marijuana cases. Following the passage of that Texas Hemp Act, and I'm not suggesting that is the cause of the backlog by any means, it's just one contributing factor, we experienced the highest backlog in our seized drugs case history with 21,720 untested drug cases in-house over 30 days. Following that peak in the backlog, we were able to implement a brand new scientific method that's unprecedented in our seized drugs community, allowing us to start testing the marijuana cases again starting in August of 2020. There was a pause for approximately a year while we developed that method and trained in it. Next slide, please. So some of the challenge that we were faced with early on, as I mentioned, we were faced with an existing backlog. Additionally, we had some turnover. We have a great training program. We have phenomenal forensic science professionals
who would get trained, and then they would go to other forensic service providers who had better compensation packages. So we were dealing with a lot of turnover at a rate that was impactful to our backlog. Part of the challenge anytime in DPS when you lose a well-qualified position is that you have to train that position, but then we have to take senior scientists off of casework in order to train that person. So our existing people have to train our future. So case production additionally goes now down, not just because of the vacancy, but because we have to train our peers. In 2019, as I mentioned, we had the passage of the Texas Hemp Act that required a brand new scientific test method. And again, the forensic community and seized drugs had never been faced with this challenge. Prosecutions became hindered while we were developing that method because we had no way to test for the presence of marijuana and differentiate that from hemp. And we had to disallow the submission from our external customers, and that's about 85% of our business, non-DPS customers. We had to ask them to hold those plant case submissions until we're able to develop that method. 2020, after development of the method, we had to train and competency test our entire fleet of forensic scientists, also unprecedented when everyone has to go into training at the same time. So not only were plant cases impacted, but all felony casework was impacted, our production. A conversation was renewed, increased focus again on the fact that we in the crime laboratory don't test misdemeanor cases for seized drugs. We're not resourced to test misdemeanors, and that's not new. We've always only tested felony cases. That we make exceptions at time based on prosecutorial need, but operationally our focus is on felony cases. And by not testing the misdemeanor cases, especially the plant cases, there became the perception that we were legalizing misdemeanor marijuana, which was not the intent. So we had to overcome that perception and that challenge. On top of all of this, COVID-19 happened. And in a crime laboratory, you can't take evidence home. You can't telecommute with evidence. You need your scientific instruments. So throughout the pandemic, we were working. We were working in the labs, and we had to pivot so we could ensure that we were still meeting the needs of our law enforcement community. One thing to know also that in the development of that new method that's required based on the passage of the Texas Hemp Act takes twice as long to process a plant case than it did before with the old method. And because this is heavily reliant on instruments, there's increased consumable and instrument costs that we hadn't had before. So next slide, please. How we combated some of these challenges is we did seek additional positions through the 86th legislature, and we were successful. The legislature was very supportive of meeting our backlog, helping us meet our backlog challenges. And they gave us funding not only for additional positions, they recognized compensation needs, help us with our retention, and they gave us additional equipment funding so we could replace our aging fleet of instruments, which proved beneficial to meet the needs of the marijuana identification with the new method. We also hired a seized drugs program coordinator who's a subject matter expert, a chemist who allowed us to establish a standardized vision and direction for our seized drugs community going forward. We also hired a system seized drugs trainer to help alleviate the burden of that local trainee on the local labs. And again, we have 13 testing labs here in DPS for seized drugs testing. We did have to evaluate new methods, but we established a consortium. This wasn't just a DPS challenge of the new method. It was any forensic service provider in Texas, so we partnered with them as well as Sam Houston State University so we could in the most efficient manner establish a method that worked throughout Texas. We validated that method, we trained, and during that time we were able to identify a vendor and contract with one who could help us test those misdemeanor highway patrol cases for the presence of marijuana. We also leveraged that contract to help implement some simple case felony outsourcing. So while our chemists were focusing on the more complex seized drugs cases, the easier to identify cases we could send to a vendor. We identified a funding source for the first time in a long time for overtime, which Chief Mills will speak to in a moment. And also for the first time, we took a Lean Six Sigma approach to insourcing cases based on capacity across our 13 labs. We had never done that before. Because of the need to keep them local for testimony purposes, one of the unintended. One of the benefits of the COVID-19 pandemic was that court shut down. So that allowed us to move those cases around without having to worry at that time about upcoming testimony. At the same time, we partnered with IT to begin establishing dashboards so we could see where our backlog was, locations in real time where we hadn't had that opportunity before. Also, we were able to combat the backlog by implementing that method, so we began testing marijuana cases again, and external customers could submit their cases. Here's an example of a Tableau dashboard that was developed. You can see the peak of our backlog in red at 21,720 cases, and you can see since then we're heading in the right direction. We are successful when we are that squiggly lines on the bottom, that noise that you see at the bottom. That means the amount of cases going out are meeting the current needs. However, we've got to figure out how to get that backlog down even lower. And the reason for the second line, those are our current open requests. So those are the number of cases we have in-house, but the difference is those are under 30 days. So moving on to just focusing on the wins this fiscal year 22, you can see that we have reduced our backlog by 50%. The goal for fiscal year 22 was to get to a 10,000 case backlog. We accomplished that a few months early, and we're already halfway to our next year, the second half of the biennium goal of 5,000. We're already halfway there, and we haven't hit the start of the fiscal year. So a lot of our changes have been very successful.
And just to speak to the funding opportunities, we did leverage the outsource vendor about $800,000, and then overtime for about $300,000. The $800,000 is funds that we get reimbursed by the individuals that are charged with crimes. So that is a source of funding that we can use both for drug outsourcing today, but we could use for other things to support the laboratory going forward. As our backlog is eliminated, our thought is to use that money to help both the time of our scientists will be alleviated, and the money would be there for us to start doing some researching to help laboratories, but also help law enforcement across the state with some of the other drug challenges that we have, such as fentanyl and the precursors of fentanyl. From an overtime perspective, we did use border funding on behalf of the director's office, and $300,000 of that has allowed us to eliminate a portion of the backlog. But as it is eliminated, there will not be a need for that going forward as well.
So in summary, we have been able to decrease our backlog and seize drugs. The number as at the end of July, if you'll click, is 7,638 cases, which we're back to 2017 numbers. We hope to get down to a zero backlog in the next 2 years. Change that's forthcoming is we will roll out the new method to test liquids, oils, and waxes for the presence of THC. Again, that was a change because of the Hemp Act. That new method goes into place September 1st, but with all of these changes, we don't see that to be impactful to our backlog other than in a positive way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And that is concludes the briefing, if there's any questions. Commissioners, any questions?
One question. You just alluded to it. My question, that is, what was the change in the Hemp Act that required a different testing method that takes twice as long as the old method?
So we used to be able to just identify the plant and the components of the plant and whether THC was present. The change in the Hemp Act also changed the definition of marijuana to include the concentration of THC. And so the laboratory would have to move from just the identifying the presence of THC in these items or the plant to quantitating or semi-quantitating the amount of THC in items or the plant material.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to say it's very impressive to see how you recognized a problem and immediately went after it and have been very successful. Very impressive, the number that you have, the last number on the slide.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Any other division reports? Moving on to consent items, item 11 on the agenda, I'd entertain a motion to approve all consent items.
I so move.
Second.
A motion from Commissioner Wainwright and a second from Commissioner Strachill to approve all items under Section 11 consent items on our agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Section 12, items for future agenda. Commissioners, please make Phil or Sophie aware of any items you would like to see on a future agenda. The next regular Public Safety Commission meeting is scheduled for October 13, 2022. Discharge hearings will be scheduled for October 14, 2022. The Public Safety Commission will now go into closed session at this time pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, Chapter 551, to consider matters authorized to be considered in executive session under Government Code Sections 551, 071, 072, 073, 074, 076, and Government Code Section 411.0041. The time is 12:49 p.m. The Public Safety Commission has entered a closed session, is now reconvened as a quorum and open session. Note for the